Yes, unicorns,
Why?
ninjas. So it's funny, the language we use is always a really interesting place to look for insight into the cultural stories we tell. And we use a lot of language around wizards, priests, magic, mythical creatures to refer to programmers and programming jobs.
Welcome to the JS World Podcast, powered by passionate people. Here we interview our speakers from the JS World Conference. We talk life, tech, and all sorts of things. Like what we have to offer? Like and subscribe. And don't forget to follow us on at JS World Conf on Twitter.
Hello.
Maggie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's so nice of you to do an interview with us.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Thank you for being here, yeah.
No problem.
How is Amsterdam?
Rainy. Very, very, very cold and rainy.
It's crazy,
yeah,
right?
You picked the wrong day. It's even snowing.
Had we done this a week earlier, it would have been so nice. Like 15, 16 degrees, sunshine, good weather to see.
Yeah, at least then we could have given you the best impression of the city.
Yeah. It's all right. I mean, I'm from London, so I don't have high expectations. Ooh, so yeah. This isn't, you know, anything so that different to home, frankly.
This is summer holiday for you then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you feel right at home.
That's so nice. So, Maggie, so for me and Renee, it's also, we don't do this very often, right? So we're kind of improvising a little bit here. I hope you don't mind.
You're doing
mind.
Very well. Don't worry.
Already? We just started.
We're not even 5 minutes in yet. So what I want to do is I want to talk through your bio because you have a super interesting bio, right? So for anyone that's going to be listening in, this is Maggie's bio. She says, I sit at the intersection of design, anthropology, and technology. These three are at the core of everything I make. Combining them into a coherent career is a weird and ongoing challenge. My work at Egghead involves designing visual metaphors for invisible, complicated software concepts. On the side, I'm always working on illustrated essays that explore the cultural side of digital technology, and in my digital garden of notes, you'll find a good amount of linguistics, cognitive metaphors, cultural speculation, and tool nerding.
There's so much to unpack.
I apologize. I never had that read out to me out loud, and it sounds
quite
an eclectic combination. Yeah, that's true. But it's also like, man, there's so much to unpack in that.
I think it's super interesting because where do you find a developer that says, I sit at an intersection of design, technology, and anthropology?
There aren't many of us. I'll definitely give you that.
So how? Many questions. Let's start at the basics. How does this work?
Right. So the anthropology bit is I studied cultural anthropology for my undergraduate degree and specialized in digital anthropology. So looking at the cultural narratives around digital tools and systems, essentially. So I was especially interested in like the quantified self movement and how we collect data about our bodies and how that helps us to tell different cultural stories about our bodies. So I was very interested in, yes, the cultural anthropology of all things related to tech. But of course, I graduated with an anthropology degree and was not employable in any sense. But I had been building websites throughout high school and college for fun and then realized I could get paid for that. Probably like just before I graduated and started thinking, okay, this is going to be my career more than anthropology. Because at that point, I already knew it was either a PhD or you're unemployed. And those are the two choices. So I just went into that and I was much more interested in the design side of things. So I learned to code out of necessity to build my own sites, but I've always been much more of a designer. So I'm more of a design dev hybrid, but I'm still interested in like now, you know, having worked in development and design for a decade, I'm now more interested in sort of the cultural narratives we tell around programming and development and especially around developer tooling and really like how we can improve the world of programming through making things more visual or reflecting more on the ways that our cultural narratives and histories have led us to this point where developer tooling is very much this interpreted as very logical, rational, text-based, sort of based in science and maths, where that wasn't like a cultural necessity or a cultural inevitability. It could have gone many different directions. We still could in the future go many different directions with it. So I'm kind of interested in alternate narratives of what programming could be.
So you obviously have a clear idea of these narratives. Would you mind sharing one of these theoretical narratives? Yeah, I'm curious because as you say, like programming is seen as a very hard domain, so to speak. It's very factual, right? So I'm very curious where you can see this going from an anthropological perspective and how we can maybe even skew that narrative away from it being math-based, very logical-based, into something that's more creative, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I think always about like the historical legacy of it, right? Very much coming out of, we think of the US as kind of a center of programming historically, and especially places like Stanford or MIT, and this idea that it is very hard logic. And that it turned out that like computers, even in the beginning, were thought only to be large calculating machines, right? For large companies, like even the idea of personal computing, of individuals using computers for anything other than calculations, was unheard of before the 1950s and 60s. And then the 1960s, there were all these innovative thinkers like Alan Kay and Douglas Engelbart at Xerox PARC in California who went, well, what if an individual could use a computer to draw a picture? And that was wild at the time. That was wild.
Isn't that the Douglas that introduced the voice interface and started drawing with the voice interface? Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's Douglas amazing. Engelbart.
I don't actually know about that.
In 1969, he did this thing called the Mother of All Demos, which was the first time anyone saw video conferencing. It was the first time they had really seen lots of graphical user interface interactions, like point and click was what he invented. He's known as like the guy who invented the computer mouse, which is kind of the least of all his inventions, honestly.
This is crazy. This is so strange.
Yeah, and so he kind of had all these researchers working under him who ended up working at Xerox PARC. And they're the ones who were the first ones that ever put a graphical display on a computer for like a commercial product, which was the Xerox Star. And it was this sudden explosion of people who weren't mathematicians having access to computing power and using computers to write, you know, screenplays, make films, make music, make visuals, which before that point was no one had ever thought computers could ever be used for that. So that's the sort of example of like a turning point in history where we reframed what we thought computers could be used for, and it completely changed the course of programming in history and the way computers are used now, and led to what we have now. And it was much more about telling a different story about what computers could be.
Wow. So if you look at the things that computers could be now and how we're using it, where do you think this is going to go in, say, 10 years? What's your take on that?
Hard question. I can say what I would like the direction to go in, let's say. Because at the moment, right, of course we have widespread access to personal computers, right? We all walk around with phones in our pockets. Everyone does this, from like our grandmother to the mailman. Like, you don't have to be a computer technician or programmer to use a computer. But we're still in a phase where we think that programmer is like a designated career, a very specialized skill that only some people have access to. And you're paid very high amounts and you're held in very high esteem in society if you know how to talk to a computer and control it. And it's not that we're gatekeeping that skill, but at the moment, the ability to program a computer is still constrained to a group of individuals who are seen as very special. And we sort of mythologize them, right? As like the Mark Zuckerbergs, right? Or the people that run Google, as like they have to be geniuses to know how to
control. Wizards.
Yes.
Like the digital wizards just doing these crazy things exactly. With your machine.
It makes so much more sense now seeing all these ads for looking for development ninjas.
Yes. Ooh. Unicorns, why? Ninjas. So it's funny. The language we use is always a really interesting place to look for insight into the cultural stories we tell. And we use a lot of language around wizards, priests, magic, mythical creatures to refer to programmers and programming jobs.
Makes so much more sense now. Knowing this information, I never thought of it as in sort of a cultural narrative where we try and skew ways so that you feel special, you know, because as you say, we are this quote-unquote minority group that know how to talk to a computer. Even though it's a skill that anyone can learn, we're seen as
even in that whole range of even between developers, we have this kind of mythical type of narrative going on, like have the superstar programmers, the rock stars,
10x,
the 10x programmers. Oh, I can feel like the hairs on the back of my neck go up from 10x. Oh my God.
So it's not to deprofessionalize programming, right? That's not the goal. There will always be really hard programming challenges that people need to be dedicated experts to solve. But I think we can drop the floor way lower to allow way more people into a lower level of programming. I think the narratives around it being a genius skill kind of need to drop away. And I am seeing more now what we're calling low and no code tools. Mm-hmm. Like Zapier allows someone who doesn't know any programming code to write an if this, then that statement, right? If I tweet, then add this file to my Google Drive or whatever. Those kind of interfaces and those kind of platforms we're seeing a rise in, and I hope we continue to, because it gives people who don't have any specialized programming skills access to the same power the developers have had for decades.
But even then, exactly, for example, the if this and that movement for your smart home, things like that, or even what I had with my parents, I remember that they have the one remote for everything, but you have to program the remote. And as soon as you tell them you have to program the remote, it's like, oh, that's something I can't do. That's impossible. It's too difficult. It's like still this mythical thing of programming something to do what you want, which is just very kind of, yeah, intimidating to a lot of people. So how do you think the visualizations and things like that could fit into breaking that barrier of lowering it?
I definitely hope it does, and that the more we have, I mean, in the talk I gave this morning, I talk about how visuals work because they play off our embodied understanding of the world, and that, like, we are humans with bodies and we all know how to move around objects, and we all know how to look at a complex visual space and understand a lot of detail and complex ideas around it, because we're designed to do that evolutionarily. We have incredible visual skills and visual cognitive processing. And the more that we can move programming into things that are based in graphics and visuals, the easier it will be for people to be able to use those tools, to be able to build complex things without knowing their programming. That thing of, like, don't use the word programming, just say, just draw a line between these two boxes and write what you want to happen in these two boxes and it'll happen. And don't make them think they're, like, having to learn a specialized skill.
So is it maybe then the linguistical understanding of the word programming that then introduces the barrier for people, because it sounds, or the association with it, is a difficult one?
Yeah, and it's interesting to even think, if you look at, like, writing in history, right? Not everyone used to be able to write. That was a specialized skill for scribes and priests. And then education made it so that we, like, introduced this curriculum where we're going to teach everybody to write, and we're going to teach everyone not just to write words, but write complex essays. We're going to teach them to construct arguments. And that's now taken as for granted as a skill in almost everyone in society, that to some degree they can write, and they can write persuasively. They can, you know, write letters to each other. They have this as a baseline skill. And it'll probably take a while, but I would expect that we're going to start introducing that as a core skill to most of society, is basic programming, at least to some degree, even if it's just kids learning it organically, because they find the Shortcuts app in their iPhone and they're like, oh, I can, you know, chain together sequences of logic.
Wow, this is super interesting to talk about, because I've never actually approached programming as a something that extends beyond just talking to a computer. But talking to you made me realize, like, there's so many things that we actually don't see when it comes to what we do as programmers. So this is how the cultural effects are, how the effects are on our educational system and these things. I'm just super curious where this is going to go. This is incredibly interesting so far. So when we let's take a step back from the whole anthropological part. And how does this work in your day-to-day life, in your day-to-day job?
Does it? So I currently lead design at a company called Hash. So I was with Egghead for 5 years, but I switched companies in October. And Hash does more, like, large data analytics and simulations, so trying to help companies simulate possible decisions based on large data sets. So it's a little bit more of a different thing, but I'm helping to figure out visual interfaces that would help make that easier. I think the things around what I care about with, like, what I would call end-user programming, that's the idea that end users, or what we just call users, should be able to program, is kind of a philosophy that goes into democratizing programming, making programming easier for everyone. I probably explore that more through the essays on my website, through talks that I do, like writing outside of my job. My work at Hash definitely plays into that. Like, we want to make simulations and large scale data management easier for more people who aren't necessarily developers, but it's definitely more directed at companies or large corporations versus, like, empowering a single individual to be able to do more on the ground programming.
Okay. So, and if you look at things like GitHub Copilot,
What's your
take on that?
Really interesting. I've been using the beta for 6 months now, and it's quite impressive. I mean, it has some limitations. And I know they just released Copilot Labs, like, this week, which is a new plugin that, like, is gonna help people. It looks really interesting. You can, like, put in a piece of code and it will explain the code to you in plain language. I get really excited seeing things like that, because it makes me, I love the idea of someone becoming, like, an accidental developer. Like, they stumble into this world and they have something like GitHub Copilot that can sort of hold their hand while they walk through, like, a code base and explain it to them, or it helps them, like, write a React function when they almost don't know what React is. This thing of, like, it allows people to come in and explore and play and go, oh, programming isn't, like, the dark art I was told it was. Like, this is, I can read this. I can figure out what to do with this. So those tools, I think, are going to be really promising in just opening up the field to more people, and mostly, yeah, making it less intimidating.
Okay. So something that I did, question that just popped up into my mind. Looking at GitHub Copilot, it takes away some of the heavy lifting from developers, especially if you are new to the whole development world, new to writing these kinds of languages and using these tools. What's your take on the whole transition using machine learning, using AI? I say AI, quote unquote.
Yeah,
it's
quote
not
unquote,
actually
yeah.
AI, it's just statistics, basically. But yeah. Do you think that that's going to have a huge impact on us as developers in the way we do our work? Is it going to, I'm asking many questions now, I know. Is it going to replace what we're doing as humans? Is it going to be automated?
No, right? I mean, that's always a long historical narrative of the robots will take our jobs, right? Has been played out over and over and over ever since Frankenstein was written, kind of thing. It's like this fear of the machine that is going to come and take away something that is inherently human. I mean, things like GitHub Copilot, ideally, right? No one wants to genuinely sit there and manually write a function if they already kind of know what it should look like, but they just have to sit there and literally tap the keys to make the thing happen. Versus GitHub Copilot, you could just like press tab and the whole thing appears. And you still had to architect the app. You had to do the higher level thinking, the stuff that humans are actually good at. More like you had to think through what do users actually want out of this? What kind of experience am I trying to give them? You're thinking about the much higher level cognitive stuff. And you don't have to spend time manually writing like a function when you could have written that function 1,000 times in the past. And it's just this like physical process of actually doing it that we have to keep repeating.
Okay. So it's automation of the things that we should automate,
mm-hmm.
and leaving the higher level stuff to the actual brain and do the thinking, the architecting. And as you say, sort of given the input, I want this output. And then everything in between should be automated in a sense.
Okay. Yeah. Like there's so many small things that have been solved 6,000 times, right? Like, or should have been solved many times over, and we still fail at, like, even basic things like accessibility on the web. Like, what if the GitHub Copilot could just, like, fill in all the accessibility features you need to when you build, like, a tab component? And then you don't have to, like, go look up the docs for that and, like, test all your stuff and make sure it actually works. This thing of, like, if we can actually start using AI to improve code across the board without putting that burden on developers, that's a win for everyone, mostly end users.
I think it makes more sense now what you said, the new feature, the Copilot Labs, where mm-hmm. they actually walk you through the code, because I fear that if the algorithm takes that away from you
mm-hmm.
And takes away that heavy lifting, you don't actually understand what it's doing at some point, right? So how do you see that balance in the future, where the balance between we automate pieces of our code, or it's being written for us by another computer program, but we still want to have a good understanding of what is happening?
That is hard. I think that's why they probably built in this feature of explain the code to me, because I assume it works in reverse, that right, if GitHub Copilot writes you some big function and maybe a bunch of it is actually messy or unnecessary or it doesn't quite do what you expected it to, as long as it can then explain it back to you in plain language and make you realize what it's doing, because otherwise it could just be like, oh, I don't actually understand why it's doing this loop in the middle or why it's put this extra function in. I think that must be a really critical piece of it. I mean, the whole thing's still in beta, right? It's still incredibly early days for this stuff. But it being able to explain itself is one of these core problems for AI that I know runs across almost all AI projects, is like, can you get the algorithm to tell you why it made that decision? Because otherwise we end up with, right, like the horrors of like Facebook news feeds where it's like no one knows who's seeing what or why they're seeing it, not even the Facebook developers, so they can't be held accountable for what someone else sees that they have no record of, that they weren't in charge of the algorithm.
It's the magical algorithm.
Yeah,
problem.
The big black box.
It does something and nobody knows exactly what.
Yeah.
But I'm also interested in this part, like the, if you do the generation of kind of programming and just mm-hmm. basically clicking boxes, getting that kind of low easier tooling to create yeah. something, that's also going to give like a gap maybe between two types of people or the two groups, because you're still going to have those. Like the people that are going to be using the tools, they can make new kind of stuff that they couldn't do before because they didn't know programming.
Mm-hmm.
But the tools still have to be created by the older style programmers.
Yeah.
So there's going to be kind of an interaction between those two groups. Like, how do you see that? Like,
yeah. I'm definitely a big fan of adding visuals into existing tools. So I love, my favorite example of this at the moment is Stately AI, which is a fairly new product, which is a state machine library that you can, it's like a VS Code plugin. It's also its own standalone web app. And what it does is it shows code and a visual diagram side by side that are in sync. So if you change the code, the diagram changes. If you change the diagram, the code changes. So you're never only seeing a purely textual representation or a purely graphical. You're seeing both and they're connected. And those are exactly the kind of tools that I hope we move more towards. That's where it's like people who don't consider themselves programmers might be more afraid of those, because it does have what they would think of as like dark screen, you know, long line of code, you know, sort of like this is the serious stuff sort of interface. But once you see them side by side and there's a diagram explaining to you what the code on the right is doing, then it's like, oh, like the mystery has been solved. Like the magic is gone. I get exactly what's happening in this like otherwise intimidating code file. So hybrid interfaces, I think, are a really interesting part of the solution, or I hope what we move towards, in that it's not like end users get a graphical interface and real programmers still use text, but you find a happy medium in the middle that both like convert traditional programmers to be like, oh, there are valuable things we can get from GUIs, and get people who don't consider themselves programmers to accidentally see code that they're controlling and realize like, oh, I can write code. I don't have to turn this into a profession. I don't have to study a bunch. I can just use this tool. And I now understand more about how code works and how development works.
I get like a whole new picture of like a new collaboration. Like what you see with the business, my current client, for example, you have some of the business rules that we implement. And then there's a small bug in there that you give your translation of what you've written to the business. They say, yes, that's correct. And then you still have the bug in there. But if you have this kind of bridge, they can actually reason about what the code is doing as it's written. But that would actually open up like a whole new type of collaboration between the technical staff and the one that's doing the business ruling. Mm-hmm. I think that would actually be very cool to see such a sort of collaboration going on.
It'd be super cool. I think it lowers the barrier of communication between technical side and any other side that the technical side has to work with. This is super cool.
I like this bridging between the tech and actually the visualization, because the visualizations, we already see that in our work, like how powerful it is. There was this technical thing in my work, and it was, if you explained it, it was so confusing. And then I made a diagram of it and it showed them, and they're like, oh yeah, now we all get it.
Right.
So it's the power is clear.
I'm so sad that we weren't able to see or talk this morning because we were setting up the whole podcast room.
Yeah, we were busy with the mics.
We were so busy here. I really want to see more of this. We'll hear more of this. I'm looking at the time and we are going to have to finish up. I just have one more question for you, and that is, here it comes.
Ooh.
Future of programming, is it going to be visual?
I hope so. I don't know so. But all signs point in the right direction. Like, I'm seeing so many new tools, developer plugins, interfaces, new startups getting lots of funding that all point in this direction of that we all know we need to democratize programming more. We're all aware that programmers hold a ton of power that needs to be shared around. And just this problem of, like, developers run into all the time if they can't explain to their stakeholders, their designers, their CEOs, how the code runs, and we need these sort of translating interfaces. So I'm seeing a lot of people both putting like time, money, energy, love into interfaces that help bridge that gap and make them more visual for everyone to use.
Cool.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you. This is great.
Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
We certainly did. This was so much fun. We're still trying to get the hang of things.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a fun day.
It's going to be an incredibly fun day. Maggie, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, and until the next one.